Terry Bullingham, Reel 1. Whereabouts were you born, please?
Cheltenham.
And which year was that?
Born in 1944, at the end of the Second World War.
Did you go to school in Cheltenham?
Yes, went to school in Cheltenham and left there in 1960. Left Cheltenham Technical High School in 1960 and joined the Royal Navy.
What had your father done for a living?
My father had been in the Navy during the Second World War. He was a Second World War veteran.
So was that the reason you decided to go in for it yourself?
In the 1950s, I'd been in the Sea Cadets. I obviously liked the Navy, it was part of our family history. And I'd been in the Sea Cadets from 1955 to 1960 and liked it, very much so. I was lucky, really, because I ended up doing in the Navy what I'd always wanted to do. I'd always wanted to do electronics. And when I joined the Navy, I quickly transferred into the Fleet Air Arm. So I ended up working with the technical excellence of aircraft and, of course, having the beauty of naval travel. So it was the best of both worlds for me.
What type of things were you expected to do specifically in your job?
Well, I was doing electrical maintenance on aircraft. In the 1960s, it was Sea Vixens, and in the 1970s, it was Phantom on the Ark Royal.
And what were you doing when the Falklands crisis broke out in the early part of 1982? What was your job and rank and so on?
Well, at the end of the 1970s, because of the demise of the heavy jets, and prior to the advent of the Sea Harrier, I moved on to the anti-submarine variant of the Wessex 3 helicopter. And I was looking after flight control systems and the armament on that, the electronics of the armament systems on that aircraft, with the rank of a Chief Petty Officer. I'd been a Chief Petty Officer since the end of the 60s as a technician.
Now, coming on to the Falklands crisis, can you take me through it step by step in detail, starting with how the news first broke for you?
Yeah. Spring 1982, cold spring in this country. We were on our spring exercise down in the Madeira area off the coast of North Africa in end of February, March. And we had a sort of annual, our sort of interval during the exercise where all the ships went into Gibraltar. And it was a good social exercise in Gibraltar, visiting each other friends in the Fleet Air Arm on other ships and getting to their bar before they could get to ours. And so the whole Gibraltar experience is rather sort of rosy tint to it. None of us really noticed when HMS Spartan, the nuclear submarine, was no longer alongside the wall with the other ships. Visiting friends on ships with quite emotive names, what subsequently proved to be quite emotive names, Sheffield, Coventry, visiting colleagues on there. Didn't really pay much attention to the world news. You don't when you're on a run ashore. But went back to sea to continue with the exercise. And I remember that during the night, because being part of the flight deck, involved in the flight deck with the helicopter, most things, people go and transit to and fro via the flight deck on a modern ship. So we were sort of at the hub of all the buzzes in the hangar and everything, all the rumours. And it came from the ops room that we were going to, that there was something on, and there was more to this scrap metal men in South Georgia than we had first thought. And we were to pair off with other ships and relieve them of their stores. And I remember this, the ship that we paired off with was HMS Ariadne, and we started to take her war stores from her, wash-up torpedoes, live 4.5 shells, the sort of things you don't normally handle. Certainly don't handle hanging off the strop of a helicopter, a live torpedo, or live depth charges coming across, nothing like that to concentrate the attention. Detonators, live ammunition, belted ammunition. Hey, we're in the Navy, and we're not in the Army, what are we doing handling this sort of stuff? So we stripped Ariadne out of all her stores, and other ships in the company were doing that to their parent, their other ships, twin ships. So Ariadne would come back to the UK, and we proceeded south, transiting, with hindsight, rather too quickly through the tropics, the beautiful waters around Ascension. And we went down to relieve what was known in the Navy affectionately as the Red Plum Endurance. During the South, when the Argentine Marines invaded South Georgia, the Endurance had gone south of South Georgia to hide in safety on the ice. And she came up round to meet us at Antrim, and I think it was Plymouth with us. And we relieved her, sent across stores, forget the order, but it was obviously eggs, potatoes, and the all-important beer. It was big cheering, because I think she was fairly desperate for food. Cheering, it's all good stuff. And it was all sort of, everybody on the ship was sort of latched onto the World Service. We all got to know Lily Bolero by heart. Was it on, was it not? How are we going to get the Argentines off South Georgia? And eventually, on our way down south, we'd also picked up some members of the Special Air Service who'd come from another part of the globe to join us. And eventually it was all decided that it was going to be on, there was going to be a proper seaborne assault on South Georgia. Our ship, the Antrim, was we had the flag with us, and so we were the hub of all the planning. And because we had a big the admiral's cabin, which was used for that, was big enough to plan in, to get everybody in. Planned that it was on. There's a sort of kaleidoscope of events now, 11 years on, that I can't put into correct chronological sequence, but I'll have a go. There was one thing was to be able to, what the word was, insert, quotes, insert the Special Air Service into South Georgia so they could come round behind the Royal Marine, behind the Argentine Marines and get at them from behind. And this became quite a difficult operation, bearing in mind the marginal weather in this area, I mean, really marginal. And tried one attempt to put the Special Air Service and the Special Boat Service ashore in Gemini dinghies. One drifted off, didn't, the motor failed and drifted off, and I think that was subsequently recovered heading for South Africa 2 or 3 days later. The SAS got ashore, the ones that got ashore out of the Gemini's, didn't manage to get very far. They managed to get up the Fortuna Glacier, but even for the SAS it was marginal. And they became stuck in weather, so they couldn't achieve their mission of coming round onto the Marine, the Argentine Marines. And our helicopter, which is known as Humphrey, affectionately known throughout the ship as Humphrey, one of the tasks it was to recover them. And we also picked up two Wessex 5 helicopters from a Royal Fleet Auxiliary Tidespring that was in company. And they were to try and recover these Special Air Service personnel. The problem with the Wessex 5 helicopter is rather like a flying lorry. It doesn't have any sort of avionics fit or very rudimentary flight control system. And when they were trying to get the SAS back off the Fortuna Glacier, they had what was a whiteout, total snow. And one Wessex 5 touched down and fell on its side. The other one crashed. The Wessex 3, which was in company with its superior avionics fit, was able to get back to the ship. It didn't crash because he could fly blind. And what we're going to do, we had the very precious personnel, the Special Air Service, very specialist ashore, stuck. And the boss, our boss Ian Stanley, and obviously the hierarchy of the ship decided it was worth a go. And so we stripped out the whole sonar system on the aircraft to cut the weight down, because the Wessex 3 wasn't designed to transit carry troops. So we stripped out the sonar, took out the dunking sonar equipment, and quite a big operation from a maintenance point of view, ripped the guts out of the cabin, and the boss took it back up the Fortuna Glacier, and his story will obviously come later, but he managed to come back with 17 of the SAS in it. It was a last-ditch scene, the weather was clamping in, and he came back to the ship, and I always remember this, there was no time for messing around, just came sideways straight onto the flight deck, pull it down. The aircraft was grossly overweight, the engine didn't show signs at the time of being stressed, it showed it later, I'll go into that. But he got them all back with no loss of life, and it was a very successful operation in less than marginal conditions. The other thing that I became actively involved in, it was decided that we could then go in by a seaborne assault. The big worry was that the Argentine Navy had a converted Guppy, American Guppy submarine known as the Santa Fe, and it was thought to, it was known to be in the area. And it just shows that the power of the submarine threat, how it could it was paralysing the whole whole part of the task force. Where was this submarine? Quite a conventional submarine, not a glamorous submarine, an obsolescent submarine, but it still was a problem for our ships. Where was it? Well, this was back then, back to the role of Humphrey. This was what Humphrey was designed for, anti-submarine helicopter. Put all the sonar equipment back, put all the equipment back in the cabin. Said so easily now. A lot of night work, a lot of, for all the maintenance crew, a lot of red-eyed stuff, just working on, getting all back in. The air crew took the Humphrey away. It was a Sunday morning, took her away, and just by the observer, Chris Parry, just happened to see the blip on the radar of her conning tower, found it, went in, came back to the ship. We want live depth charges. We have them ready. We want a live depth charges, and make a live torpedo ready. So this is the real thing. This wasn't playing. This wasn't exercise. This was handling the real thing. Live depth charge, 400 pounds of explosive. Looks like a beer can, beer keg. Live torpedo. Hundreds of thousands of pounds. Never mind that, that's also got another 350 odd pounds of explosive in. So things that make you concentrate when you're handling, especially after you're tired, and especially sort of 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning. Not so. Came back, we loaded the deck's icy, we loaded a depth charge, and we loaded two depth charges. Humphrey went away, they got him again on the radar. The submarine saw Humphrey coming, tried to do a crash dive. Humphrey put one depth charge went in and exploded, I believe, as advertised, alongside the starboard side, which did damage the Santa Fe, crippled it. Subsequently here afterwards that in the actual Santa Fe itself, ship's torpedo rolled out of its stowage and actually took somebody's leg off. One of the Argentine sailors took his leg off. But I think the damage was fairly limited, but it did cripple the submarine and forced it to head for South Georgia, get alongside the jetty. Humphrey came back with a depth charge on. We want to swap the depth charge for a torpedo. Unloading a live depth charge, winching it down and putting a live torpedo on. Went back, other ships in the company, HMS Plymouth with her Wasp. The Wasp went in and had a go at the submarine. HMS Broadsword with her Lynx, they went in and had a go at the submarine. And then decided it wasn't any worth pursuing the submarine any longer. Antrim and Plymouth were going to do a naval bombardment on South Georgia. Hadn't been done for a long, long time. The Navy hadn't done for a long, long time. The gunnery crew on the ship, high state of excitement. All the time that this is going on, we're at full action stations. The ship is actually moving around at full speed ahead, 34, 35 knots, job to stand up on the deck, heeling over. The speeds that aren't normally done in peacetime, just all the stops taken off the throttles, moving as fast as possible. And we moved in, us and Plymouth, in a traditional naval bombardment. Subsequently, speaking to people from British Antarctic Survey who were ashore, they said from their point of view it was impressive. 4.5, modern 4.5 shells coming in. We fired 69, Plymouth fired 80. And that was sufficient to convince the Argentine Marines who were ashore, the 200 of them, that it wasn't much point in pursuing the exercise. What they'd actually done, they had actually erected defences on the beach, and they, when they heard the shells exploding behind them, they thought people would come round behind and were going to come in from behind them. So it was a relatively easy matter to move in, for the SAS and everything to move in, and they surrendered readily. And that was on the day of Sunday, April the 25th, and the ships came in to the old whaling station at Grytviken. The Argentine Marines were taken on board Tidespring as prisoners of war. The notorious Captain Astis, who was of the Argentine Marines, was taken into Antrim and put into the doctor's cabin under special surveillance, because he was regarded as a not a very nice character. He'd been involved with torturing nuns before the Falklands campaign.
Did you see him?
Saw him come to the flight deck, yes, but didn't think he came to under guard. Wasn't sort of, we were all tired then, we were sort of pretty sort of exhausted because of the events of the day and the previous night. We were just knacked, not to put too fine a point on it. But he did come through and he went in the doctor's cabin, and on the Antrim we had a detachment of, Royal Marine detachment of a dozen, and two of the Royal Marines were on the cabin door. That was the time when our Captain Young, when we got alongside of Gripvickan, the White Ensign went up, and that's when he sent his famous signal back, which I can't quote verbatim, but be pleased to advise Her Majesty that the White Ensign flies alongside the Union flag at Gripvickan, South Georgia. So that was the retaking of South Georgia. We escorted Tidespring, the RFA Tidespring, with her 200 prisoners of war back to Ascension, where we were going to get rid of the prisoners of war. And we then thought, well, this would be the end of it. The Argentines, they've had a lesson, had a bloody nose, and it's not, that'll be the end. How wrong we were. Carried on the General Haig and all the peace, efforts towards peace. Once again, everybody in the ship listening to the World Service when we could. Quite protracted preamble to the Falklands thing. Wonderful to get back to Ascension again, back into the tropics after having been down in full foul weather gear down in South Georgia. To say something about South Georgia, we were down in the area there for a couple of weeks. One particular night I remember when we were right down in the South Georgia area. To show you how bad the weather was, it was a Force 11 one night, and the helicopter, which is normally lashed on the flight deck, was starting to break loose. In fact, it actually cracked one of the castings that lashed it down, and actually cracked. It was only held on three of its four lashings. And I remember phoning through to the officer of watch on the bridge and I'm saying, can you give us any better course, sir? In other words, a course that's not, that's not so, that protects the flight deck from the wind, because the helicopter is starting to break free from its lashings. And he says, that's the best course I can give you, Chief. That's the both best one. So we had to decide to send the maintenance crew out to put more lashings on the helicopter. And it became obvious that anybody who went over the side wouldn't be, there was just no way that they'd be recovered, they'd be dead. Because, I mean, the temperature was just on freezing point with a Force 11. And I remember when we went out there, I was stood there in full foul weather gear. So that's a full anorak, trousers. Overalls under that number 8 action working dress, and under that didn't have long johns on, but I remember when the wind blew you felt you were naked. It went right through the lot, and 11 of us got around the helicopter, all holding onto each other lifelines, and fastened extra lashings, doubled the lashings and trebled the lashings to make sure it stayed there. The whole helicopter's been covered in salt, and it was just like a nightmare, but we managed to hold it there. And after 3 or 4 hours, in about 4 o'clock in the morning, the weather did abate. I put that in to actually, it's difficult to imagine, you know, even it's the sort of weather that you never get in the UK at all. It's sort of weather you have to go up to Iceland and Faroes to get in the Northern Hemisphere. And I think it's sort of when it would Force 11 on the freezing point and at sea. I mean, a hurricane force, it just reminds one of how puny man really is. So, after those sort of experiences, you can imagine how nice it was to be back in the balmy waters around Ascension, where you can look down into the sea and see the tropical fish just as advertised, like a holiday postcard. The decision's taken, it's all back on again. The task force, the ships that hadn't been at Gibraltar in February and March, the ships that had been alongside at in the UK, were starting to... They started their journey, Hermes, Invincible, other Canberra, all these sort of ships, the Fearless, the Intrepid, all the well-known names were all starting to make their way south. So we started to go back down again. No longer had the flag with us this time. Admiral Woodward, Rear Admiral Woodward, had transferred his flag to HMS Glamorgan. Quite poignant afterwards. I'll try and feed in a bit of feedback after that. HMS Glamorgan was actually a sister ship of Antrim. We were the only two ships of the class there, of the old county class. In other words, Glamorgan had a Wessex 3 as well. Going back down to Falklands, still all of us not really thinking it was on, oh, no, they're going to give in, and this is the Royal Navy now, the might of the British Royal Navy, and the Argentines aren't going to really pursue this thing to the end. Wrong. On the way down there, Humphrey then decided that it was his day, and started playing up. And I remember being up doing a check test flight with the boss. We had trouble with the autopilot, and being up with the boss, and we were about 4,000 feet. And it's a sight I shall always remember, because we were actually above the task force at about 4,000 feet. And even at that height, you know, they covered quite an appreciable stretch of the ocean. The last time I'd seen Alamantis ships was at Spithead Review in 77. And sort of ironically, there were probably more ships then than we have as Royal Navy now in 1993. They were there, the Invincible, their little sort of arrows of their bow waves and their wake, the Invincible, Canberra, big white thing, she was white, the Canberra, the Hermes with her sort of ungainly ski jump on the bow, and a host of other less glamorous but equally worthwhile ships. They were the logistic ships of the Knights class, Sir Geraint, Sir Tristram, quite emotive names now, Sir, I can't remember the names, Sir Lancelot. There were about five of those, various other sort of merchant ships, and the leaner shapes of the frigates and destroyers was protecting them. As a sailor, I should always remember, it's quite emotive that, actually seeing all those ships, and you realised then that we weren't going to the Falklands for a run ashore, because of, to say nothing else, there's a sheer expense of getting that amount of ships together a long, long way south of the equator. Various planning exercises. I'm still quite a of the smaller war as a smaller vessels. Antrim was still quite significant because she had good communications and she was being used for a lot of the planning. And we were sort of doing all the preamble for the Falklands. Humphrey again, true to form, then decided to, the engine then decided to show that the cost of recovering those special air service from South Georgia, and the engine actually just packed up. And it was decided, well, obviously we'd have to change the engine a lot quicker than we normally did. Everybody mucked in on the flight, and I think we did it in something less than 24 hours when the standard time was 36. There's nothing like the real thing to focus the attention and get the team spirit going. And so tired, and everybody being conscious of, you know, the fact that tempers are frayed, but we all knew each other very well. Most of us had been together for a year, and we'd be understanding of each other. You know, if we snapped at each other, we tried to understand that, because we were all very tired, air crew, maintenance as well. Change the engine, and the main thing we would select is to be one of the ships to go in on the initial assault into San Carlos Water, which is the strip of water between East and West Falkland, to cover what was the main thrust of the thing, was to put the troops ashore. That was elected to be the safest point to do it. On the night before, we had special air service and special boat service embarked again. They seemed to be very much part of our lives. They were embarked in us again. And on the way in the night before, dark, totally black, we slipped quietly in, and there was a hill on the way in. I forget it was on the east of West Falkland, and it was rumoured that there was a hundred Argentine Marines on this hill, and obviously they were going to be an embarrassment. So one of our missions was to make sure that these Marines were not allowed to continue in existence. So the Special Air Service and Special Boat Service, that was their function, was to take them out, I suppose, to put them into the gung-ho expression. It was deemed that this should be done by the ubiquitous Wessex Fives again, the flying lorry. I remember this was quite a sort of exciting time. When a Wessex Five came in to pick up some of the Special Air Service, they got into this Wessex Five. Quite an inexperienced pilot, especially deck landing in total darkness, which was very much an acquired skill for a fleet-air-arm pilot. And it sort of partly took off and then came down again on our flight deck, but this time it didn't come down in the right place. And the tail wheel was hanging almost in space. Just by good luck, it was just sitting on a lamp, on the lamp housing. And the other, on the his starboard wheel, was way over, nearly on the edge of the deck. And we were all praying that this lamp housing would just continue to take the weight of the tail of the aircraft. Because it wasn't just a Wessex with aircrew in, it was a Wessex with troops in as well. And there was quite a lot of excitement there. But eventually the pilot gathered himself together, lifted the collectors, and lifted them all safely out of it, thank goodness, because that would have been awful if it had that, an incident on our flight deck with a visiting helicopter. It would have blocked the flight deck for any use for us for a start, because we regard the anti-submarine helicopter as being pretty important. Remember, as we went in, the troops were sure. And this was another quite exciting time. It was about 2 a.m, totally black. And I remember the commander saying, fire 2 sighters. And he wasn't talking about firing a rifle. He's talking about the twin 4.5 mounting up forward on this hill. 2 sighters went in. They obviously had the range and the bearing. He then said, fire for effect. This is the sort of thing that we'd only been used to seeing in films. So it was a real thing. 2 a.m, 4.5 shells streaking for this hill. The SAS and the SBS, who'd ring the hill at the bottom, for them it was easy. The Argentine company of 100 soldiers came running down the hill into their ever-eager grips. And I don't know the nitty-gritty of what went on there, but sufficient to say the Argentine Marines were no longer a threat. Next day, we're in San Carlos, anchored, other ships around us, significant ships' names. I remember we were next to HMS Ardent. And I suppose the first thing was really when we knew things were on was when the Pucaras, little propeller driven, nothing sophisticated, nothing, no fancy sort of glamorous aircraft, little propeller driven Argentine aircraft, came in and started to payload bomb Ardent. And I can remember there was a sort of certain elation went round us on the flight deck, and an excitement, hey, you know, this isn't on, we're British, we're the good guys, you don't bomb that, you know. And it was just splashes in the water at first, but then it wasn't splashes in the water, it was hits and orange flashes. And we also realised, with a sort of sickening realisation, that these aircraft, they weren't just hanging around. Once they'd done their run, they were going behind the hills and promontories of land, so you didn't see much of them. And you suddenly realised that all the drills, all the stuff we've been told over the last 20 to 30 years, the ship's weapon systems were a bit impotent, to use its broadest meaning, because they were all based on radar. And the most important thing we had, actually, was the good old 4.5.